everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. We are so excited about today's show. We have a jam-packed show. We're going to be talking to the wonderful writer, Susan Abohawa. We're also going to be talking to journalist Prem Thacker. And as if that's not enough, we're going to be talking to Larry Aubert, who is a 26-year-old active duty Air Force member who's starting a hunger strike. We're going to be talking to him and Anne Wright, the retired colonel, former U.S. diplomat who resigned over the Iraq War. Before we do that, though, just a quick reminder to please like the stream. It's an easy way to support the show. Just give it a thumbs up. Also, we're almost at 200,000 subscribers. So if you haven't already subscribed, please do subscribe, press subscribe, and then hit the bell so you never miss any of these streams. If you can become Patreon supporters, we so appreciate that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And if you give $5 a month, you get great bonus content. If you give $1 a month, you just get to know that you help make this show possible. We literally couldn't do this show without it. Also, belated happy birthday to Phantomus Fanta, because his birthday didn't fall right before or right after a stream. So thank you, Phantomus Fanta, for doing all the clips and happy birthday. And early by one day, happy birthday to a friend of the show, Nick. Alrighty. So excited to be bringing on our first guest. Susan Abohawa is a Palestinian-American writer and human rights activist. She's the author of Warnings in Jenin, which was translated into 32 languages and sold more than a million copies. The Blue Between Sky and Water and Against a Loveless World. And I've read all of them and they're all wonderful. She's the founder of Playgrounds for Palestine and the executive director of Palestine Rights. And she is joining us to talk about a recent trip that she made to Gaza. So welcome, Susan.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what you did in Gaza. What made you want to go? How long you were there? What you saw? Just start, I guess, from the beginning in terms of what you were doing there.
Well, I can't really talk about how I got in, et cetera, but I went to do whatever I could, basically. It's weird to explain the desire to be there. It's kind of, I don't understand the desire not to be there. Why wouldn't everybody want to be there? You know, somebody in Gaza actually asked me, aren't you scared being here? Like, we have to, we don't have a choice. And I thought about it, and quite honestly, it felt harder to watch them from afar than to just be there with them. To watch an extermination unfold, live streamed to the world, and be paralyzed and not be able to do anything was intolerable. And I suppose that was the impulse to go in the first place. And once I was there, it was in part to bear witness, also to bring in whatever supplies I could bring in to drop in the ocean of the need that exists there. And also to sort of get some programs going through Playgrounds for Palestine for children, in particular, psychological first aid. I also held a writing workshop for young Palestinian writers to help them begin to narrate their lives in this moment, because I think they should be the authors of this historic moment, not anybody else. And that's something that I'm keen to really follow through with, to try and ensure their voices come out of this in narrative form.
And how was that? How was it teaching these young people?
First of all, they're immensely talented. I didn't know who they were or what their level of writing was, and it was a beautiful surprise how what excellent writers they were, and the stories they had to tell. my role was really trying to help them hone in on the details. The impulse is always to sort of give the overarching sort of narrative. I was just trying to impart what I've learned as a writer over the years of the craft. And they're all writing in Arabic. So the workshops were conducted in Arabic, which means that I've recruited, I can read and write Arabic and I can provide input on the structure of their stories and stuff, but ultimately the language needs a different editor. And so we've recruited other writers from the Arab world who are going to help with this. And hopefully, inshallah, we'll have an anthology come out of this.
Oh, great.
These are small things, Katie, that, one person could do in Gaza. Of course, it's not changing the situation. And ultimately, it means nothing except in the lives of those few people that are directly touched by this small effort.
Which is meaningful. It's not on maybe on a macro level, but it's makes an impact.
Well, it's what I could do. That's what I could offer. And that's what I'm willing to do whatever I have to do.
I mean, I know speaking for myself, it's just a fear of death that makes me not go. Sometimes I just say, I really should be over there. And then,
yeah,
that's what it is.
And yeah, and I understand that. And actually, there's a part of me that was thinking, before I left, I made a will and all that. And, but then I'm like, I'm not better than anybody else. And my friends who've been killed there didn't deserve to be killed. And at the end of the day, if I'm going to go, I'm going to go in Gaza.
And tell people about your personal connection to Palestine, you and your family's connection to Palestine.
I'm Palestinian. I don't.
Like from where and what kind of journey they had to make?
We're from Jerusalem, from a village outside of Jerusalem. It's called At-Tur. My family were expelled like everybody else in 67.
And tell us more about what you saw in Gaza. I mean, I know it's probably very painful to talk about it. And I read some of your really great pieces in Al Jazeera and Electronic Intifada. But you talked about things that were so horrible, which I don't even want to ask you about unless you want to bring them up. But, experiences that parents went through with their children. What are some of the things that you can share that you want people to know about what's happening there?
I mean, I wrote about most of the individual cases. There's actually tons more people that I spoke with. And actually, after I returned, there's a psychologist that I was working closely there, and he told me about a woman that he's working with. He got her permission to tell me. I don't know her name. She was abducted by the Israelis. She was held in detention and I think it was 3 weeks, and she was raped by nine soldiers. Her children were killed. And her husband, she knows nothing about where he is. He was injured, and she doesn't know if he's alive or dead. And, what he described to me is harrowing. And I got that story a few days before the stories about the rapes at El Shifa were starting to emerge. So there's also... besides the outright rape stories, there's also a lot of other sexual crimes, of like, for example, it has, and I heard this from a few people, when they strip, when they, you know, when they go into, when they invade homes or invade schools or whatever, of course they strip the men usually. But there were several cases where they stripped both the men and the women, and they made them all stand in the same room, and they were blindfolded, and they would take their blindfolds off. And of course, everybody's, you know, immediate reaction is to close their eyes to spare everybody else's dignity. And they, but they told them that, you know, they made them look, and they said, open your eyes. And said, if you don't open your eyes and look, we're going to shoot you. And they were shooting people who didn't just look. So that was happening. I mean, it's just crimes on such a sadistic, systematic, unreal scale. I mean, you know, I think we all understood for a long time how, what a pathological society Israel was. But to see how truly pervasive it is within the whole society has in some ways been surprising. I mean, to not be, for the entire society to not be at all moved in any way by this ineffable agony that they're inflicting on people is something that I think scientists are going to be studying for decades, because this is a truly sociopathic society, and it should not be welcome among the rest of humanity. It really should not. This kind of sociopathy is really shocking, and I think maybe the world is finally seeing what Palestinians have had to live under for so long. It's this like psychopathy that has been, you know, branded as morality and the most moral army and the only democracy and all these other asinine slogans that bear no resemblance to reality.
It really is unbelievable to see people defending Israel now, given all we've seen on social media. I think it was easier to be in denial about Israel before, and now it just requires real either dishonesty and, you know, a genuine disregard for Palestinians, like they just don't care, or brainwashing, or some kind of, as you said, psychopathy. And the fact that even among Israelis who are critical of Netanyahu, it's not, some of them are critical of him from the right, that he's not killing more Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of support for the amount of force, except that they want more force.
I mean, even here in the U.S., there's some, you know, that Wahlberg, Congressman Wahlberg, calling for, you know, of course, he tried to walk it back a little because of the backlash. But, you know, we all heard him. This they're also like gaslighting the whole world. Like, we hear and see what the hell they're doing, and then they come on and just like with a straight face and say, no, we didn't. That's not how it was. Hamas did it. You know, it was an error. You know, targeting and firing three separate missiles into the WCK clearly marked cars. Oh, it's just the fog of war.
Yeah. One of the things that you wrote about, because you wrote in your articles, you wrote about individuals, and you, of course, changed their names. But one of them was a woman who had something really terrible happen to her and her family and her husband. Can you and you have a photo of something that was etched into his back. But before we show that photo, can you just set up what happened here?
Yeah, this was a young woman she actually, it was a kind of a heroic story. She rescued her husband from Israeli soldiers. They had a harrowing few weeks of running from one place to another from bombs. 80 members of her family were killed in a missile strike. But she was with her husband and his family, and they were going from one place to another. They eventually ended up, and I don't mention the place because I don't want to give any details that could give them away. And they were surrounded by the Israeli military, who eventually came in, soldiers, guns blazing. They were shooting everywhere, all over the walls and spraying. And when they finally came in, they separated the men and women, as I just said. The men were all stripped, and the women were packed into like this, like it was almost a janitor's room. Like they were on top of each other, kind of, and just, and the women and children. And then for 3 nights, they weren't given food or water, and they could hear the men screaming through the night. Like they were clearly torturing them. And then on the third day, the soldiers came and ordered the women to go south with the children. And all the women went except her. She, at this point, she just had nothing to lose. And she said, "I'm not leaving without my husband." And she's quite young. I mean, they'd only been married for like a year. And so she just started running between the two rooms, trying to find him where the men were. And they were all, stripped, and it was dark, and she couldn't, she couldn't see. And she kept calling for him, and she eventually recognized him by his boxer shorts. And she was hugging him and kissing him. And then she was alternating between like pleading with the soldiers and begging them to let him go, and then cursing at them and just attacking them. And eventually, they were laughing and, calling her crazy. And they were it was almost like an amusement thing. And eventually they were like, okay, fine. And they cut him loose. Anyway, by the time they got, somewhere safe, she saw on this, he showed her his back, and it was carved with the Star of David. And then his uncle later showed his back was carved with smiley faces on his shoulder. Like, they were just carving pictures in people's skin.
So disgusting.
Yeah. And I saw somewhere, someone else posted a photo of a man whose face was branded with the Star of David. You might have seen that one as well.
It's such it's so disgusting. And Israel always talks about anti-Semitism and weaponizes it and, claims it's there when it's not there. But it's just so rich to see them.
Yeah.
Painting these religious symbols.
Yeah. Honestly, I think Jewish people really need to take back your religion. I mean, I feel like you guys are in a fight that's pretty profound too. Because Israel claims to speak for Jews worldwide, and they're weaponizing anti-Semitism, and they've convinced the world that this is this is the Jewish sphere. This is the Jewish focal point in the world.
Yeah, no, and I think that's why organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace are so important. I mean, I've been saying this lately, that I speak out on this because morally, it's awful for people to use our names to justify genocide. And like, I don't want that to happen, right? So it's just a moral question for me. But there is also it's not as big of a factor for me, but it's there. There is a self-interest that I want the world to know that Israel doesn't represent all Jews.
Yeah.
Like, they don't speak for me. They don't speak for lots of Jews. And they contribute to anti-Semitism. Israel does.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, they're claiming ownership of Judaism. They're claiming ownership of Palestine, of a history that's not theirs, of a story that's not theirs, of food that's not theirs, of property and homes and heritage. And this is just the biggest heist the world has ever known, I think, by organized, militarized mafia.
And what else do you want to make sure people know about that you observed? I know that you talked about on other interviews, the trauma that is facing, that especially children are dealing with.
So, you know, there's so many things that, and I keep saying this, that sometimes I don't feel like I have that. I have the right words or that language is big enough to really contain what Israel is doing in Gaza. The level of agony in everything, in every moment of existence. There's not even like in a lot of conflicts or wars or whatever. There hasn't really been a genocide in this like this. There's sometimes a bubble, you know, that some people get to exist in. It doesn't exist in Gaza. Everybody is in utter agony and destitution. Everybody has been reduced in some way. People who just 6 months ago were, you know, building a house or getting married or planning, you know, or applying for PhD programs or graduating from college or whatever. People who had all kinds of ambitions and plans and are suddenly now thinking about nothing except where they're going to get water for the day and where they're going to get food and whether or not they're going to live to see another day. Like, this is what I mean by a total reduction of people. And, you know, it's a dismantling of people's dignity, you know, not people not being able to bathe for months on end, it's just hard to describe how horrific the situation is in every conceivable way. Every moment of every day, people are suffering profoundly. Like, if you can imagine, people's cortisol levels are raised 24/7. They just don't come down. Everybody's nerves are frayed. Israel has that zanane, that really loud drone that it seeps into your body. Like, you like, even when I came back, I was still dreaming about that stupid zanane. It's just, it buzzes in your brain 24/7. It's intentional, right? This is intentional to just make people fall, just, you know, have nervous breakdowns. Just everything is disintegrating. There's no privacy, you know. You can't be with your spouse. You can't sleep in the morning because the neighbors are intense. Everybody's kind of, you know, everybody has to get up at the same time. You're sharing a bathroom with hundreds of people, and it's not really a bathroom. It's a hole in the ground. I mean, the indignities are in every conceivable way, just claw at your humanity, at your personhood, at your will. And this is to say nothing about the constant terror, the endless bombing. Every night that I was in Rafah, which was supposed to be the safe place, they were bombing every single night that I was there. I don't know what more there is to say beyond, you know, the videos. People have seen everything. At this point, nobody has an excuse. Nobody on social media has an excuse not to know what's happening. And I saw somebody posted something the other day I don't remember who it was, so I can't give credit, but they said something like, at this point, you're either advocating for Palestine or you're a sociopath.
What about the food? You tried some of the food. I mean, what, like, where were you? I know you can't reveal a lot, but where were you able to even stay? And what was the food that you were eating? And
I'm glad you mentioned the food, because the World Central Kitchen, despite, you know, I mean, I read some of Jose's tweets that came out later showing that he was, you know, advocating for Israel in some ways, but which was hugely problematic. But when I was there, the work they were doing was really important. All of the hospitals were depending on meals from the World Central Kitchen. All the there's a lot of organizations who are caring for families. So the way it's most people have just sort of ad hoc set up tents wherever they could find space, and everybody starts to fend for themselves. But eventually people sort of got organized into groups for protection, for services, for just management. And so some of these groups then were taken over by local organizations. And so these local organizations have taken charge of distributing meals to the people that they're responsible for. So there's a few of those, and they all depend on the WCK's daily meals. Now, there are a lot of, you know, other sort of kitchens that have just popped up. Most of the kitchens that were already there were contracted with WCK. And I hope they'll be able to still continue. But honestly, at this point, without the WCK meals a day, there's going to be even like far greater collapse. So what Israel has effectively done is, first of all, they shut down UNRWA by withdrawing funding. I mean, they've marginalized UNRWA, and it's just shocking and extraordinary how they did that. Just sheer lies that everybody bought.
With no evidence, while there's crime after crime that Israel commits, and we're still funding them. And then there's no evidence of UNRWA, and we defund them.
Exactly. And then the other large organization is ANERA, Americans for Near East Refugee Aid. And they assassinated their director in Gaza. And now, you know, and ANERA continued to function. But now with this new targeted assassination, ANERA has shut down their services. And then the WCK has shut down. So Israel has effectively shut down the three major aid organizations who have kept Palestinians alive just barely in the south, not in the north. There's nothing is in the north. People are literally just starving to death in the north at this point. There is famine in northern Gaza. In southern Gaza, people have been able to survive on some of those meals, and then like these canned goods that are coming in through Egypt that are kind of gross, but it's some level of sustenance, and people are living on it. Mostly, it's mostly fava beans, and if you can, cheese, stuff that tastes, it's really rancid. And then there's some makeshift ovens, bread, you know, tabuns, what we call them, for bread making. And people are making their own bread too, because some flour is available in the south, although it's really, really expensive. Yeah. I mean, there's a few small farms that are still operational in the south. Most of the farms have been bulldozed and bombed. There's a few. And so very, very rarely you will find some produce, but it's really expensive, and it's like gold. I think most people in Gaza have not had a piece of fresh fruit or fresh vegetables in 6 months, at least.
And the World Central Kitchen that Susan's referring to, we'll be talking about this more in our second segment with Prem Thakur. But that's, if people don't know about this, there was an Israeli airstrike which killed a Palestinian driver and six international workers from Chef Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen. And the charity, of course, has suspended aid operations. And the aid workers were driving in a clearly marked car. They had already given Israel a heads up about the trip they coordinated in advance.
I just wanted to clarify that it wasn't one strike, it was three. So, you know, these coordinated, the deconfliction protocol is very clear. Like when you, when somebody, before anybody travels, any of the aid workers travel, they give the names, the car, the license plate, the color of the car, then and the exact route where they're traveling. And so the WCK cars were marked, they were deconflicted, they had like on the roof, it was very clearly identified as a WCK vehicle. And they hit them the first time. There were some survivors who crawled out, went into another car. They hit the other car. There were a couple of survivors that crawled into the third car, and then they hit the third car. So this was, they hunted them and they killed them. And this was, and they're trying to say, again, they're gaslighting the whole damn world, trying to say that it was an accident or whatever.
I mean, when even they don't, it's just unbelievable. I mean, nothing surprises me when they kill Palestinians. Like that goes without say, but you'd think that they would be afraid. And then here's images of that. You'd think that they would not want to touch this celebrity chef's organization, but they have such a deserved sense of impunity. When I say deserved, I don't mean that they deserve to have the impunity. I mean, their sense of it is well deserved because nothing does happen to them.
It's not the first time, though. I mean, they, you know, they've done this before. They've done it before, and they, you know, they survived the scrutiny because they just bullshit their way out of it. Like initially, they tried to say that they were killed by a Hamas bomb. They tried to say that, and but it didn't quite work out with the evidence because they said Hamas had planted a booby trap bomb for them. But except the missile strike was very clearly through the roof of the car. And so that didn't work. And they said, it was an accident and we're investigating, whatever. They're inveterate liars. And I don't know why anybody even quotes them or gives anything they say any kind of credence.
Susan, I would you agree that I would say they're probably, what they're investigating right now is figuring out the specific line of Hasbro that they can feed the rest of the world that would, some people may buy it, but I don't know. Clearly they're not actually investigating.
No, they know exactly what happened because they ordered it. They ordered that it happened. This was a calculated move to shut down the WCK because the World Central Kitchen was able to bring in a lot of food aid through this new maritime corridor, and Israel doesn't want it. They literally want to starve Palestinians. And
Susan, was there a member of the WCK that at some point in the past few months was critical, publicly critical of the Israeli government or Netanyahu that would have potentially also elicited them, you know, vengeance for their, you know, I don't know.
Not to my knowledge, actually, quite the contrary. So as a matter of fact, so Jose has come under a lot of criticism from Palestinians because he had actually a tweet he made a long time ago was uncovered where he talked about Israel having a right to self-defense and going after Hamas and just buying that whole Israeli Hezbollah line. And he also provided meals to the displaced settlers. And so he was a friend of Israel. But again, like Israel has no friends. Israel is in it for themselves. And yeah.
Yeah. I'll get out of here. I just wanted to say, Susan, I just can't thank you enough for being here and doing what you did and do. And just thank you very much.
Thanks, Bradley.
I just wanted to ask you one more question because I know you have a meeting, but you also wrote a great piece at Electronic Intifada about, called Reject Biden and Build a Better World. Can you talk about the case that you make in the piece for people who haven't read it? And then I'm going to ask you to react to a video.
Yeah, I mean, basically that, you know, Biden should not be elected no matter the alternative. It would be the biggest mistake we could ever make. 4 years of pain with Trump is better than allowing a genocidal war criminal to be reelected because of the signal that it will send to the political elite and to the ruling class. I mean, I just, it frustrates me to no end to hear Americans say, oh, but, you know, we have to, no matter what, we have to hold our nose and elect Biden. Like, enough of this, enough. Like, what more is it going to take for people to just stop accepting this this no choice and pretend like we live in a democracy when year after year we have a choice between two war criminals that don't represent us, that don't look anything like the like America in any way, morally, economically. They just, you know, this is the ruling elite who don't give two craps about the population in this country, except to just assuage folks just enough to get their votes. Just taking our tax dollars and playing these horrific imperial games on the world stage that are destroying the planet, that are destroying life, with the singular purpose of increasing their own personal power and their personal wealth. And ultimately what's happening in Gaza is precisely about that. It is unbridled greed. It is unbridled colonial insatiability for land and resources. They want Gaza, and they want Gaza's offshore gas. That's the bottom line. And, you know, Jared Kushner, another monster in his own right, said it openly. He said that's valuable oceanfront real estate. Like, who the fuck are you, Jared Kushner? Like, why does he even have a voice in this? Just a New York white boy who thinks he should have some kind of a say.
It looks like he's made of wax also. Neither here nor there, but...
Yeah, he's not from the same species you and I belong to, for sure.
Yeah, thank God. Well, yeah. Given... And is there a third-party person that you are supporting or excited about?
I mean, I would support any third party. I mean, Cornell is running and Jill Stein are on the ballot. Those are two people I'd be quite happy with. I'd be happy to vote for.
So given what you just said, I want to give you a chance to respond to a video featuring someone who I'm sure you're going to be very upset to disagree with, because I know she's a real moral person for you. And you two always align. Let's take a look at Hillary Clinton on the Jimmy Fallon show. Being asked about, of course, the election.
It's Biden versus Trump.
Yes,
we know that.
It is.
What do you say to voters who are upset that those are the two choices?
Get over yourself. Those are the two choices.
Yeah, love that.
Right? And
good.
You know, it's kind of like one is old and effective and compassionate, yeah, has a heart and really cares about people. And one is old and has been charged with 91 felonies.
Yeah, okay.
I mean,
okay, interesting.
I don't understand why this is even a hard choice, really.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
Yeah.
But we have to go through the election, and hopefully people will realize what's at stake, because it's an existential question. What kind of country we're going to have, what kind of democracy we're going to have, and people who blow that off are not paying attention, because it's not like Trump, his enablers, his empowerers, his allies are not telling us what they want to do. I mean, they're pretty clear about what kind of country they want.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
get out there and vote.
So has she changed her mind, Susan?
Oh, yeah, because I really listen to Hillary.
You're with her.
My God, this woman, like, she's... This is the woman who went and tweeted and was so up in arms about the Barbie movie and the fucking Oscars. And meanwhile, Palestinian women are being raped. They're having miscarriages. They're malnourished. They're getting bombed. Their children are not a single word, not one word of solidarity, of compassion. She does not belong in the ranks of womanhood or even in the ranks of humanity, frankly. And, you know, for her to tell us to get over ourselves, I don't think so. And I think we need to find a way to make it clear to her and people like her that, no, you need to get the fuck over yourself, because we're not going to keep playing this game. And I am of the school of thought that we need to burn the whole thing down. Like, this is not okay. These two no choice choices that we get constantly, and then pretend like we live in a democracy that everything isn't run by a tiny elite group of people who basically own the media, own the political class. They own the courts. They own everything, and they run our lives. And we get to pretend like we're voting and that this matters, because I don't know. And, you know, it's funny, the one single thing in all of this that seems to be a wild card, at least for that has the ruling elite sort of up at night, is TikTok.
Yeah, right. Israel has a TikTok problem.
Right. They've been able to sink their claws into Meta and into Twitter, and they've got those basically under control. They've got them spewing what they need to spew and banning Palestinians and shadow banning Palestinian content. And then, of course, they own the newspapers. The newspapers are, you know, being led by the New York Times, which is basically an Israel mouthpiece. If you look at their coverage, from the New York Times to the BBC to CNN for sure, MSNBC, all of them, and Hollywood. So, I mean, they have everybody sort of, and the publishing industry even, you know, like they are gatekeepers of public thought and public information. And we never thought that this could happen with the internet. Like, when, you know, I'm old enough to know what the world was like before we had internet, and there was a chokehold on information because there were definite gatekeepers. And you couldn't, you know, you watched the news or you read the newspapers. That's how you got your news. And they owned it all. They controlled it. And they told you what was going on in the world. But with the internet, we were like, wow, it's open. We can finally, like, but no, they've managed to control and regulate what people get to see. And now TikTok comes along, and it's not as manageable, and they're not, you know, they're not complying with, you know, these information wars. So Congress comes along and does Israel's bidding once again, and then of course they dangle the boogeyman, China. There's always a new boogeyman for Americans to be afraid of. It's gross. But I have a lot of faith and hope for this new generation that, you know, that's really starting to see things more clearly, and certainly clearer than my generation did. And I hope that they will keep seeking and just, I don't know, burn it down. Just burn it down. I don't, we can't continue to live in this two-party system, because we see how it has now culminated in just an overt, outright extermination campaign. And, you know, Biden is sending more dirty bombs as we speak. And presumably they're going to be used in Rafah, which is unbelievably crowded. Like, that's another thing. I didn't really talk about that, but how the density of people is really hard to take. It's hard to bear. Like, you can't move. You can barely move around. And they want to drop dirty bombs there.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining. I really encourage people to read Susan's writing at Electronic Intifada, also Al Jazeera, but also her novels are really wonderful. And I'm excited about what you're working on next.
Thanks, Katie. It's good to see you.
You too. I would put her Twitter on there, but she's been banned by Twitter, which is also always a good sign. Sign of progress. A sign that, you know, something that should go on the back of her books as blurbs. Banned by Elon Musk. So, really excited to bring on our next guest. And if you haven't already liked the stream, please do like the stream. Give it a thumbs up. Our next guest we're bringing on is Prem Thakkar, who is a politics reporter at The Intercept and is a former reporter at The New Republic. So, welcome, Prem.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Everyone. Thanks for joining.
Absolutely.
I wanted to start off by playing an interaction that you had with Matthew Miller of the State Department. Here's a clip of you asking him about a Haaretz article on Israeli kill zones. But before we show that clip, can you just provide some background about what this article revealed?
Yeah. So this article, as many folks might have seen, it came out a couple of days ago. And at a very basic level, it talked about sort of this procedure in which Israeli soldiers were sort of empowered to, or directed rather, to pretty much fire at functionally anything that moves, as my colleague Nick Turse writes about the Vietnam War, in these zones. So anyone that isn't identified as an Israeli soldier, to fire upon them. So of course, that includes, you know, not anyone, not just anyone that they might think of as being Hamas, but that means anyone. And this reporting that came from Haaretz was kind of affirming a lot of instances we've seen up to this point of, you know, it seems like every day we hear reports of Palestinians being sniped in the streets. There were lots of reports a few weeks ago and months ago of Palestinians in the church complex and hospitals being seemingly flippantly targeted at. But then once the story came out, it started to, you know, affirm this idea that perhaps there are these specific zones in which Israeli soldiers are just empowered to just shoot on site. So that's sort of the pretext for this question. And I might also add just for a second that Saeed Erekat, he had asked about this first, and I chose to follow up just because Matt Miller had said that they had not seen evidence of this thing during his answer. So I wanted to sort of follow up upon that.
Got it. And Saeed Erekat is great, and he's been on the show. So
lovely.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a look at this.
Saeed's question about the reports of kill zones in Gaza. You said that, you know, you haven't seen evidence of such a thing. But, you know, we've seen, for instance, the two Palestinians who were waving white flags killed just days ago. We've seen repeated reports of Israeli snipers killing people outside of hospitals, people afraid to even walk into the streets to save people who are bleeding out. So it seems understandable to say, you know, we've seen reports, Israel denied it, we'll look into it. But to outright say there's not evidence of Israel establishing some form of this kind of practice, does that seem, you know, preliminary to say that kind of thing?
No, we've not seen evidence of what was reported in this article. Now, have we seen a number of incidents of civilian harm? Of course we have. We have seen those, and that happens in every war. And I can tell you what we have said before, which is we take those incredibly seriously. We have engaged with the government of Israel to make clear that those accounts need to be investigated. And if soldiers are found to have operated in violation of either the IDF code of conduct or international humanitarian law, they need to be disciplined.
Okay. And then on Al-Shifa Hospital, I know you've talked at some length.
And we'll get to that in a second. But so what do you think of his response there?
I mean, it wasn't necessarily aberrant from what has been said before on any number of suspected human rights violations Israel has committed in the past 6 months. One thing that I think makes this more interesting is that this sort of deference to, you know, where we have to engage with the government of Israel, we have to follow the investigation and go from there. Of course, that is kind of a line that they've drawn throughout this conflict. But obviously one key sort of issue with this line being repeated over and over again is that we get that first part of saying we want the investigation to occur, and putting aside the idea that it might be problematic for the alleged perpetrator to investigate itself, putting that aside, they express that they're interested in investigation. And beyond that, that is where it kind of ends. For instance, I've asked for weeks now about the 2-month-old now killing of Hinderjab, the little 6-year-old girl, her family, the medics that were sent to save her. Similarly, a horrifying kind of alleged atrocity as to the 7 aid workers, insofar as this was a seemingly pretty intentional attack, given that these were medics, they were sort of identified as such, and there was no reason, as far as we can tell, for even this family to be attacked. But nonetheless, you know, we've asked about this weeks on end. I've asked about it over and over and over again, about something that I've described in one of my questions as a pretty, you know, I'm no military expert. I'm just a boy. But in terms of how you would investigate such a case where there is emergency phone call, audio transcriptions, there's timestamps, there's footage of where exactly this incident took place. If you were someone that were privy to this information and was involved in this conflict in any way, even if you were on the United States, who is technically not involved, you could probably connect the dots pretty easily enough to figure out which soldiers were involved. You could interview other soldiers who might have been on the communication lines, any of the commanders on duty at the time. That is just one example of many in which, if that investigation were a priority, it would not take, I think today is day 64 since Hinderjab was killed. So we kind of see this pattern over and over and over again, where these atrocities are seen, are documented on footage or through reporting, whether it's from outlets like Haaretz to, you know, of course, you know, the many brave journalists on the ground in Gaza. But regardless, it kind of stays in that limbo where they express an interest in the investigation, but it doesn't generally move forward from there. And there have been, of course, certain instances where the IDF says outright, this was our bad, but we don't have any sort of measured accountability even for those individual cases in which seemingly soldiers are held accountable. We don't have any sort of way of understanding, A, how many soldiers are implicated in these violations, and then B, any sort of accounting publicly of how many of them have actually been sort of held to account, faced consequences. No less, of course, obviously the elephant in the room being the question of military aid. So that's sort of my reaction to that, and sort of many other answers me and a lot of our colleagues have received in the briefing room.
You also had an interesting interaction right after, we're going to play this right now, where you asked about the attacks on Al-Shifa Hospital. Let's take a look at what Matthew Miller had to say there.
On Al-Shifa Hospital, I know you've talked at some length about it, but I'm just wondering, you know, we've gone from months ago, the idea of Israeli forces targeting hospital to being, you know, outlandish, to now they've done this attack on Al-Shifa, and statedly and ostensibly they say that, you know, they've killed Hamas terrorists. Nevertheless, you know, we've seen reports of kids, women found gruesomely killed, executed, reportedly even a surgeon who was there for 172 days, treating patients killed. And, you know, some victims, we can't even confirm their identity because of the state of their bodies. So I'm wondering, you know, given this attack, given the evident lack of care for civilians, given that we can't get an update on investigations into, for instance, the now 2-month killing of Hind, the medics sent to save her, how can the U.S. approve, you know, any action into Rafah, a slice of land where, you know, 1.1 million Palestinians are seeking refuge? If a targeted attack on a hospital looks like this, what would an attack in any form on Rafah look like?
Again, do not believe that this attack was on the hospital. The attack was on the Hamas fighters that are hiding inside a hospital.
Sure, but that's sort of my point.
Someplace that they should never be. But you make a good point with respect to Rafah, which is why we have made clear we don't want to see a full-scale military operation. But I think the premise of the question, I shouldn't say the premise of the question, I don't want to attribute this to you, but the other alternative is that Israel does nothing about the Hamas fighters that continue to exist in Rafah. And we don't think that's an acceptable alternative either. So what we have said is there needs to be a targeted military operation in Rafah that targets the Hamas fighters in a way that minimizes civilian harm, and not a full-scale operation. That's been what we have been making clear to them.
Just one small follow-up on that, if you allow. I guess this just gets to a broader question about, you know, what does the U.S. see as sort of the path out of here? Like, is it political? Because what does it mean for Israel to defend itself ongoingly? Like, is it a matter of eradicating everyone who is associated with Hamas? Because that, I don't know, yeah, it doesn't necessarily seem like a goal that has led to the protection of civilians up to this point.
So there need to be battlefield successes, and there needs to be a political path forward. And that is what we have been engaged with partners in the region to develop and ultimately present to Israel. Because as you have heard the secretary say, without a political path forward for the Palestinian people, Israel and the Palestinians are going to be stuck in this same cycle of violence that they have been stuck in for decades. And that's not in the Palestinian people's interest, as we have seen over the past nearly 6 months. It is not in Israel's interest, as we saw very clearly on October 7th. And so that is the work that we are doing inside the United States government to try to develop that political path forward that we think ultimately is in the best interest of the Palestinian people, the Israeli people, and the broader region at large. Go ahead.
Okay, so his claim that Israel has no choice, but not like he presents this dichotomy where the choices are bomb hospitals or do nothing about Hamas. I don't think anyone takes that seriously.
Yeah, yeah. It's especially interesting because, I mean, I'm not going to attribute this to him, but, you know, there are a lot of people who, on one hand, say the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is very complicated. You know, you can't just sort of have one, put your stake in one side or the other. You need to have nuance, which, you know, sure, whatever. I think there are certain parts of it that surely, of course, given historical context and so on, make it complicated, but there are certain parts that I think just through observing and watching and listening and learning,
international law,
yes, are less complicated. But be that as it may, given that there are a good amount of people that say, oh, it's complicated, and then a lot of those people then also say, well, what do you do? Either you bomb them or you don't. And if you don't, then they're going to bomb you, which, you know, there's a lot of issues with that formulation, but one is just that what I was trying to get at in that question that I kind of clumsily threw out at the end was that if indeed the United States is interested in a political solution, which seemingly they say they are and seemingly would be beneficial for everyone involved, it doesn't, their actions at the moment don't seem to make sense insofar as beyond just the fact that they continue to supply the Israeli government with weapons seemingly on demand, billions in aid. Beyond that, again, putting that aside, to express willingness to approve or support or get behind some form of an incursion into Rafah, while also saying that you are working with regional partners to achieve a ceasefire, is seemingly pretty blatantly counterproductive insofar as that makes the timeline so ambiguous. You know, if you're working towards a ceasefire, which weeks ago Biden was implying that that was going to be right on the corner, that's something that I think me and my colleagues could do a better job at following back up on. Given that momentary, I think it was right before, I think maybe we had even talked about this right before the Michigan primaries, that, you know, they had insinuated that a ceasefire was coming. But to somehow imply that a ceasefire is impending, but then to continue to express to Israel that, yeah, come to us with a plan about Rafah and we'll see about it. For Palestinians, and I guess even for the political arm of Hamas, how are they supposed to interpret that? And how are they supposed to interpret negotiations for a ceasefire in good faith if they are seeing that willingness to invade Rafah is also on the table? Because then it's a question of what's the order? Is the idea that they should the United States would be interested in Israel invading Rafah before the ceasefire? Is it to come after the ceasefire? In which case, I don't think Hamas would want to agree to a ceasefire because that would functionally make the ceasefire another temporary pause. So I think that is a very blatantly counterproductive part of where the United States is standing right now. And that's just been kind of flagrantly on my mind because, I mean, I'm not speaking as a representative of Hamas, obviously. I'm just sort of if we are to play this whole realpolitik game, just going from those sort of bargaining chips and just realities, why would one entity agree to a ceasefire if it seems as if this option to invade a slice of land where 1.1 million people are is on the table? So that's kind of been one contradiction that's been on my mind throughout all this, especially, you know, with regards to answers that we see from the State Department and the White House and so on.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you to react to something. This clip doesn't feature you, but I wanted to ask you about the story about the World Central Kitchen. And to kick off this discussion, I wanted to take a look at what John Kirby said about it.
Well, on the point of conditions, the president on February 8th issued a memo, and it said, and you already know this, but just for context, it said that it was the policy of his administration to prevent arms transfers that risk facilitating or otherwise contributing to violations of human rights or international humanitarian law. Is firing a missile at people delivering food and killing not a violation of international humanitarian law?
Well, the Israelis have already admitted that this was a mistake that they made. They're doing an investigation. They'll get to the bottom of this. Let's not get ahead of that. Your question presumes, at this very early hour, that it was a deliberate strike, that they knew exactly what they were hitting, that they were hitting aid workers and did it on purpose. And there's no evidence of that. I would also remind you, sir, that we continue to look at incidents as they occur. The State Department has a process in place. And to date, as you and I are speaking, they have not found any incidents where the Israelis have violated international humanitarian law. And lest you think we don't take it seriously, I can assure you that we do. We look at this in real time.
They have never violated international humanitarian law ever in the past 5 to 6 months.
I'm telling you, the State Department has looked at incidents in the past and has yet to determine that any of those incidents violate international humanitarian law.
Go ahead, Nadia.
So we'll get to that second point about Israel never having violated international law that Kirby will agree to. But the first part, the way he reacts to that question about the Israeli attacks on the World Central Kitchen. So tell us your thoughts on that.
Yeah,
there you can see how clearly labeled it is, by the way. I think Brad is putting that in there to remind us how.
It literally says it where the bomb dropped into.
Yeah, it says it there and on the windowsill. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So while they were looking at it, they would have to have seen we're bombing right now.
There's no way they could have known, according to that piece of crap.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Brad. I think, for one, it is very interesting to imagine the United States, the White House, Republican or Democratic administration, responding to any sort of analogous situation that didn't involve this specific set of nations in this way. For even if it's early, which of course, you know, it is early, you want to naturally follow investigations as they proceed. But generally speaking, if United States and United States ally humanitarian aid workers were killed in any country, in any sort of active conflict zone, active war zone, by regardless of an ally or belligerent, but, you know, killed generally, the first statement would not be so deferential to the alleged perpetrators. At the very least, there would be a sort of baseline condemnation of things that have been seen like this in the past, regardless of whatever we're going to call them. Even if we're just going to call them mistakes or accidents, there would be some sort of baseline condemnation for this type of behavior. And then, of course, a sort of strong urging, a strong eagerness, an insistence on the investigation, perhaps even a veiled threat of some sort accompanying it, something that shows that the United States means business. As President Biden famously said just months ago, if you harm an American, I mean, I don't even remember the exact quote.
You're going to pay a price. There will be repercussions, or you're going to pay a price, or there'll be consequences, something like that. Something laughable.
I kind of let it, you know, leave my brain sometimes just because it doesn't seem like we're...
Right, repressed memory.
Yes, if you harm an American, we will respond. Very simple, very, very straightforward. you would see some form of that level of seriousness. But here, you know, again, Kirby does say there's an investigation to be had, but he's much more dismissive of the fact that this happened at all. Like, there's no sort of strong baseline condemnation of this kind of incident. It's sort of the same kind of response that we've seen over and over again of course we don't want to see something like this. But it's kind of just said as because there's, as we know, materially, there is, up to this point, have not been teeth behind such a sentiment. I think this kind of reminds me of a dynamic that we've seen sort of throughout the past 6 months, where Israeli forces commit one grade of an atrocity. The U.S. perhaps condemns it in some way and then says that, you know, they're engaging with the government of Israel to investigate. That investigation kind of exists in the ether, often exists in limbo, particularly if we don't, as journalists, follow up on them specifically. And of course, that's increasingly more difficult as these violations, alleged violations, continue to pile up. In the meantime, during that limbo, there's no material consequence, as we've seen. And afterwards, that level, that grade of atrocity at hand is then done en masse before Israeli forces escalate further to a higher grade of atrocity, all for that cycle to repeat over and over again. Because it's worth noting that this is, of course, an awful tragedy, a brutal violation, seemingly, by the Israeli government. But these are not the first aid workers. These are not the first people who have been simply described as helpers to have been targeted and attacked, whether that's aid workers, doctors, nurses, journalists, even just neighbors trying to help each other. This is not the first time, of course. Of course, there's a level of higher relevancy because of their association with Jose Andres, because of the fact that some of these people are from the West. Regardless, it's horrifying. But throughout all that cycle as well, I think it's worth noting too that, as we have seen throughout these 6 months, we've heard largely identical in proportion responses from the White House and State Department to each of these atrocities at each level as well. As in, regardless of how much these atrocities continue to sort of increase in severity and gradation, the response is largely the same materially, but also rhetorically. And that kind of functions to normalize the entire arc of this conflict as being sort of equally bad throughout, rather than what we have seen as something that has only gotten increasingly brutal on part of the Israeli forces.
Yeah, major. I mean, it literally is enabling these crimes when you fail to respond to them, when there is literally no response. And as a lot of people are pointing out in the comments, of course, when you're an American, nothing happened after Rachel Corrie was killed. Nothing happened after Shireen Abu Akleh was killed. Nothing happened after a Palestinian American whose name I can't recall, who lived in Palestine, a grandfather was killed. And I wanted to ask you about another piece that you wrote at The Intercept about, here it is, U.S. doubles down on defending, U.S. doubles down on defunding UNRWA despite flimsy allegations. Congress passed a one-year ban on UNRWA funds, even as several Western countries have resumed funding for the UN agency that aids Palestinians. So can you tell us about that story?
Yeah. So I think, I'm sure many of your viewers are familiar with a lot of parts of this saga, but one reason I wanted to write this piece is because telling the whole story in full really reveals a lot of how the United States has been navigating this conflict, so to speak. So the U.S. first suspended aid to UNRWA in around late January when the Israeli government sort of leveled allegations against 0.04% of the agency's total 30,000 employees, so about 12 people. At one point, that sort of raised to 14 people as being involved in Hamas's attacks on October 7th. And so upon that, UNRWA immediately sort of terminated the staff members who were accused of being involved in the attacks, and they launched their own investigation. And afterwards, since then, we've learned that the Commissioner General of UNRWA kind of regretted doing so. He had done so because he felt that would be the best way to sort of show that UNRWA means business, to sort of avoid already the attacks that they had been facing from the Israeli government, for instance, to really show that, you know, they mean business. This is not something that they stand for. And I believe he called it, quote, reverse due process. So he had acted immediately. But shortly thereafter, the U.S. decided to suspend funding to UNRWA, which caused a domino effect of much of the West, and namely other very large top donors like the European Union and Sweden to suspend their funding as well. And in the weeks after, these allegations kind of existed in the ether again. But throughout that time, we started to see more and more reports from outlets all across the world that either cast some suspicion on these allegations or even undermined them. So, for instance, I think it was January 30th, sometime in the end of January, that Sky News reported that it saw some of the intel documents from the Israeli government that held these allegations. And they said that they did not see proof of many of the claims. And even if they were true, they didn't directly implicate UNRWA. So that was, I believe, 4 days after the allegations were really rolling. Note that this saga started on the exact same day that the International Court of Justice ruled that the Israeli government was plausibly committing genocide. So after that, I believe it was the beginning of February that the Financial Times, they wrote on it as well. And they said that the intel assessment that they saw provided no evidence for the claims. British outlet Channel 14, I think around that same time, reported that a confidential document that held the allegations provided no evidence to support the explosive nuke claim. CBC from Canada reported that, in fact, Canada suspended its funding without seeing any evidence, kind of affirming the idea that after the U.S. made this decision, other countries just followed suit. So there we kind of see another moment where, if the historians are to look back upon this whole thing whenever, God allows this thing to end, they will look back at that moment as a moment in which that seems like a sort of alarm bell of another instance of potential American complicity, insofar as they started this whole sort of domino effect of countries suspending their funding. And so I want to fast forward a bit just because I know this really gets into the minutiae. But, you know, over time, this just continued to happen where just more and more outlets sort of cast doubt on this. And as that continued to occur, you know, more members of Congress, relatively more, began to speak out saying, you know, we can't hold 2 million plus innocent Palestinians accountable for the bad acts of, you know, 12 or 14 people. And that's even assuming these allegations were true, which conceivably, you know, sure, perhaps they could be. We still haven't seen public substantiation to that, to the degree to justify suspending aid to an organization for which 0.04% of these members were alleged to have been involved in the atrocities October 7th. And to that point, there was an instance, I believe maybe a month and a half ago by now, where I asked Matt Miller about this idea that, you know, the U.S. was quick to suspend its funding to UNRWA based off of course, concerning allegations, but albeit against a very minute amount of this agency that the U.S. itself has lauded as being very critical to work in Gaza. And at the same time, it has made not even overtures to doing the same or warnings to the Israeli government for, I mean, I don't have a mathematical calculation for how many parts of the Israeli military have been alleged to have been involved in human rights violations, but he had called the question itself a false equivalency because he had taken it to be sort of me equivocating Hamas versus, you know, the sort of justified Israeli military, which beyond just potentially any issues with that, the analogy I was making was UNRWA and potentially bad apples and for the American government's sake, the Israeli government, which I guess we can also trust at face value if you're the American government, and then potentially bad apples there. So that was the analogy I was laying out, but he had taken it perhaps a little differently. But all that to say that was sort of just a fundamental tension as this proceeded. But then, so, you know, weeks and weeks passed, and finally we get to this spending bill that it was, you know, of course negotiated, and of course there's much more in the spending bill. It's a $1.2 trillion spending bill, but nonetheless, this was one that Democratic Republican leadership and indeed the administration itself was involved in negotiating. So whatever was in there was something that either party allowed to stay in. And of course, a pivotal inclusion in this bill was cutting funding to UNRWA for a year. And mind you, this bill, once it got to the final hour of being debated and passed, came after numerous nations reinstated their funding to UNRWA because they had found that either it didn't make sense to suspend funding to such an important agency upon these allegations, or that they didn't find these allegations to be credible enough to do such a thing at all. The U.S. did not do so because they had said that they're going to continue to wait for the investigation to proceed. But we get to this point where now Congress is proposing to cut it for a year, and they proceed to pass this bill. And of course, this bill also, you know, sends billions more to Israel and so on. But that was sort of the saga just with regards to UNRWA. Where, of course, this gets much more complicated is the fact that in the wake of these attacks on Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen, now his organization is pausing operations in the region as well. And that's problematic, not just at its face, but because many in the U.S. government, many across the world, saw the World Central Kitchen as someone who could fill in as UNRWA would be, you know, sort of undermined chiefly, of course, by the U.S. government. So that's a big problem. And then on top of that, another organization, ANERA, which is another, you know, aid organization that operates in Gaza, they've announced that they're pausing too. As they said, I believe the quote was that the risk of actively delivering aid is far too great. So we started with just the initial sort of complication of the U.S. suspending funding to such a crucial agency that again, is a U.N. agency built, mandated, chartered to help Palestinian refugees. That is what this is for. The U.S. suspended funding to it upon allegations that, again, are serious, but are against a very small amount of this agency. They then proceed to continue and maintain that suspension as other countries choose to reinstate their funding. And then the U.S. government, by allowance, ostensibly, of the democratic negotiators at the table, they allow this one-year suspension to proceed. And then we have these cascading effects of now two other very important organizations that also the U.S., you know, has expressed support for, suspending their operations. So we get to the point that, you know, we talk about the fact that over 1 million people in Gaza are at risk of famine. And now the organizations that are full of brave people that are choosing out of anything that they could do with their lives to run into this, not away from it, and to do as much as they can to support their fellow human beings. We're not just defunding their work, we're actively allowing them to be killed by virtue of not having any material consequence in response to them being killed. And that is, I think saying that in very simple terms is quite remarkable, to say the least.
It's so upsetting and disgusting. And the response of the United States is so insufficient. Yeah. And this has real life consequences for Palestinians. Like, more Palestinians die when UNRWA is not there.
Indeed. Indeed.
Well, Prem, thank you so much for joining. Really appreciate all of the work that you do, both in writing and also in interacting with these interesting characters.
Appreciate it.
I'm happy that they still call on you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, credit to them at least for calling on me. I appreciate being called upon. And I hope we can, you know, keep asking these questions, and appreciate, you know, you inviting us and everyone else for your support as well. But we're going to keep trying our best and working hard.
Great. Thank you so much, Prem.
Take care.
Okay. We are going to keep this show going. We are having such a great night tonight because we already spoke to two wonderful guests, and now we're going to speak to two more wonderful guests. And that is very exciting. We are bringing on to the show Anne Wright, who's been on the show before. She is a 29-year U.S. Army Reserves veteran who retired as a colonel, and a former U.S. diplomat who resigned in March 2003 in opposition to the war on Iraq. And we are also going to be joined by Larry Hebert, who is a 26-year-old active duty Air Force member stationed at Naval Station Rota, Spain. He's on the third day of his hunger strike to demand an immediate ceasefire. So Anne and Larry, welcome.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining. Larry, tell us, please, what you are doing and why you are doing it.
Yeah, so I've been keeping up with the situation unfolding in Gaza since very early on. And I got to the point where I couldn't, you know, continue just allowing it to happen. I was naive in the beginning, thinking that it was only going to last maybe a month or two. And then what, you know, Aaron Bushnell did, I believe in February, you know, that was a very powerful, you know, act. And it really, you know, resonated with me because a lot of the feelings that he was expressing were the same feelings that I was feeling. And a lot of people do. And what really got me like motivated to come to DC and like get me off my feet and feel like I had to do something was the response after Aaron Bushnell self-immolated, which was, you know, from our leaders within the military and in our government, it was just silence. You know, there was no response. And that spoke fairly loud to me, and that they just don't care about their own people. And additionally, there was, you know, protests in Yemen, and people were holding up Aaron's image. There was people in Gaza who, you know, are under the siege and the blockade, who were holding up his image and sending their condolences to Aaron. And even Hamas themselves sent a official statement sending their condolences to Aaron and his family. And, you know, if it speaks volumes that people that we consider enemies or even terrorists are able to, you know, sympathize with our active duty military members. And even Rachel Corrie and our own government can't even speak on it. So that's what really got me going.
Yeah. And Anne, what is your involvement in what Larry is doing? Or how did you guys connect?
Well, all of a sudden, here we were in the halls of Congress with Code Pink Women for Peace every day harassing these congressmen that keep voting for wars and all. And lo and behold, one day, who showed up? This fella who said, I'm active duty Air Force. And it was like, oh, really? And where are you active duty? Spain. It's like, well, what are you doing here? Well, I came to help. And it was like, holy simole. So Larry has been with us for 2 weeks in the halls of Congress, talking to Congress people and their staffs and doing all of the actions that we have that are going on in Washington. And it's really been powerful to be able to say, hey, look over there. That guy's active duty military. And as an individual, he has come here at his own expense and is trying to say no to U.S. involvement in the weapons that are going into Israel that are killing all these people in Gaza.
Wow. And how have they been responding to you?
You mean my command?
Yeah. Oh, well, your command, but also the politicians here. And here's a picture. I showed this before, but here's a picture of Larry in front of the White House and holding a sign, active duty airman refuses to eat while Gaza starves. So yeah, have you had any politicians respond to you?
So the first 2 weeks when I was mostly shadowing Code Pink, I had, you know, spoken to some congressmen, but it was the same rhetoric that they say publicly. So it wasn't anything really different. Since I've started the hunger strike on Easter, I haven't heard from any of them. And I also I've heard a little bit from my command, but I haven't heard from, you know, my commanding officer. So.
And what have you heard from your command?
They were just reaching out just to make sure that I was being taken care of and that I was good. And yeah.
So you're based in Spain?
Yep.
And so were you allowed to leave? How did that work?
Yeah. So in the military, you acquire, you know, leave just like you would vacation time. And so I acquired my leave and I told them I was going back to the States, and that was that.
And how did this occur to you? I mean, you were inspired by Aaron Bushnell, but did you reach out to organizers? Did you do it on your own?
Just what Ann said. I just, I had seen Code Pink videos and, on social media. And, I figured that was like, that had to be the starting point. And so I ended up figuring out where they're meeting and what time. Right. And I just showed up.
And then on the hunger strike, though, all of a sudden, after he's been in the halls of Congress for 2 weeks, all of a sudden he said, I think it would be very interesting to do a hunger strike and see if that resonates as an active duty military person doing a hunger strike for the starving people of Gaza. Mm-hmm. And he put it together in like a day and a half. And the response has really been quite interesting in front of the White House.
What is the, what kind of response?
Overwhelmingly positive.
From people walking by or from?
Yeah. Yeah. And people are somehow getting my email and sending great, messages there. And a lot of, veterans, come up and have, and emailed me, just expressing how much that what I'm doing means to them. A lot of them that spoke to me, confessed that they denied serving in Vietnam, or they, got out because of Iraq or something. So it means a lot knowing that there's a lot of people with a long history of this. And what I'm doing is making an impact, at least for them.
Mm. And you're a father, right?
Yeah.
How old are your kids? I don't know how many kids you have, but.
Yeah. So I have, two kids. I have a 6-year-old and a 8-month-old.
Oh, wow. And so obviously you're not going to explain this to the 8-month-old. How are you explaining this to the 6-year-old?
I haven't yet. And maybe that's the wrong decision. But,
no, it's probably,
I have a hard time, talking about Gaza in general, let alone to my family. I don't know if I could emotionally, break that down to my children.
Yeah. And how is, how are your fellow active members, active duty soldiers, reacting to what's happening? How do they see what's happening in Gaza right now? What are their feelings about it?
Yeah. I think, cause I don't want to, call anyone out or say that, this is how they're actually feeling. But there wasn't much support, publicly about, Gaza. And I think maybe that's partially due to ignorance. Maybe it's partially due to them not wanting to be, vocally against our foreign policy, because, there could be repercussions for that. So it's anyone's guess, I guess, but, no one expressed to me any sort of sympathy for Gaza. The only comments, I heard, at least surrounding Aaron Bushnell, was, well, why do you do that? Or, that's not going to do anything. And what a waste. Stuff like that.
Is there any fear about a backlash for the Army, like because of the U.S. support for unconditional support for Israel?
Backlash for myself?
Yeah. Or against, I guess, that the U.S. Army will get involved in some way, or that the U.S. Army is already involved. I mean, Anne, you spoke about the Iron Dome.
Yes, and a Patriot, U.S. Army Patriot battery that's in Israel. And, we'll have 1,000 U.S. Army and I think Navy will be coming to build this pier in late April and early May. Supposedly, the U.S. military are not to set foot in Gaza. And one would hope that our great ally, Israel, will not mistake the U.S. military for terrorists, as they apparently did the World Central Kitchen yesterday, where they blasted with drones three different cars and killed, what was it, seven people. But in the military magazines of Stars and Stripes, Army Times, there are articles today about the bridge that's going to be built or the pier that's going to be built. And in there they say the security of our troops is the number one thing, that we don't want anybody to get hurt. Well, they are intimating that it's going to be Hamas that's going to be killing U.S. soldiers. And, you know, you never can tell, that might happen. But the one that's doing the most killing in Gaza certainly isn't Hamas. It's definitely the Israeli military, who will mistake anything for what they want to blow up.
Wow. And are you allowed, Larry, as an active duty member of the Air Force, to make the kind of political statements you're making? I mean, does the military punish that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm subject to civilian law and military law. But we still have freedom of speech, just to an extent. You know, everything that I say, everything I do is my own actions. They're not a reflection of the government or the military. So to an extent, I'm not wearing my uniform, so I'm not representing. I identified as active duty airman because that's just a fact. I am active duty. And you know, if they want to test the gray area in that with legality, then that so be it. Yeah.
Well, and if you look at his sign, it doesn't say, you know, the U.S. government is complicit in genocide or anything like that. It says U.S. airmen say no to starving children.
Mm-hmm. Refuse to eat while Gaza starves, right? Yeah.
So that's, you know, a sign of a moral conscience, more than it is a direct
political statement.
Yeah, political statement. Mm-hmm. So he's walking a fine line. There's no doubt about that. He's on a tightrope, and we don't want him to fall off that tightrope and go into the clutches of the military justice
system. Definitely not. Definitely not. I see. So it's just a moral statement as opposed to a political call.
Yeah.
And so how long are you going to engage in this hunger strike?
I don't currently have a cutoff. I would like to go on until a positive change happens, but obviously my body permits. So,
well, I want to thank you both for joining. Any final words that either of you would like to leave us with about what Larry's doing, about what the U.S. is doing, about what Israel is doing?
You go first.
Like, yeah. Do you have like 5 hours?
Yeah. Of course. For you, well, Anne, yes.
The U.S. complicity in this genocide just is beyond belief. And here we have the Biden administration saying that they are going to sell, what is it, $18 billion more weaponry to Israel to restock their defensive weapon system. Well, 33,000 people dead, 70,000 wounded, and untold numbers of tens of thousands still under the rubble. And the Biden administration, whether it's the State Department or the National Security Council spokespeople, still saying that they can find no breach of any sort of international law or breach of U.S. national policies on giving or selling weapons to another country that may misuse them in criminal acts against someone. What a bunch of hockey. Just unbelievable that they are doing that. And that's my rant for tonight. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Really important.
Yeah, I can't follow that up. So that's she said it all.
Yeah. Should have gone in the other order. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'd just like to finish with saying that we're so proud of Larry for coming here, for doing this. We know it's you know, it's a challenge as a father and a husband to leave your family and to do this, because it's heavy, heavy work. And you're disappointed every single day that you're in Congress, and disappointed, I think, in front of the White House that the policies are so bad. But then it's like people coming up to you and saying, you know, thank you for doing this because it's important and we thank you.
Yes, and thank you both so much for everything you do and for coming on the show. And we will keep in touch and looking forward to getting updates.
Great. Thanks, Katie. Thanks.
And it would be nice if the media, the corporate media, reported on this. I mean, don't they care about, I thought they cared about service members. I thought that was, something they cared about.
You might want to tell her who you've done interviews with just today.
I don't know which one is corporate media, but I guess the New York Times is probably the biggest publication.
Great.
NPR.
NPR?
Yeah. Oh, good. Okay, good. So they're trying to make
that.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it's amazing. He's got more attention, and he's on Democracy Now! This morning. So it's really his decision to go on this hunger strike has really struck a chord with a lot of people, to include media. And normally we don't get any media covering anything. So in one day, Larry has hit the jackpot.
Yeah. How has your family responded to this, Larry?
Yeah. So I called my wife earlier, and she was obviously, shocked. She was getting tons of messages. She's a pretty level-headed person. I think she has a positive outlook on things, and I do as well. It's probably why we're still together. But yeah.
And when you told her like that you wanted to do this, how did she respond?
I didn't. Obviously, like I said, conveying emotions and getting into the specifics with her was not something that I did or I wanted to do. Just because it's really difficult, at least for me personally, to express that to her and my kids. So, I told her I was going to DC probably to protest, and everything else is gonna come out after. So,
wow. All right. Well, are you on? Oh, people want to know how they can follow you. I know, Anne, you're on Twitter. Larry, you're on social media.
Yeah, I'm on social media. I have an Instagram, Larry D M E, and then I have a TikTok that I just made, hopefully to bring more light on this. But it's at Larry No Military.
That's good.
Catchy jingle.
That'll get you in trouble.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.